This is Jarrett Hill interviewing William H. Rutledge on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. This interview is taking place on September 13th, 2023 at the Amelia Island Museum of History as part of the museum's Heritage Keepers Project. With us in the room is Diane Sibilla, Mr. Rutledge's niece. Mr. Rutledge, how are you doing today?
Great.
Good. Could you tell me a little bit about your life before you came to Fernandina?
Let's start with my parents in Waycross, Georgia. My grandfather, Dr. George Atwood, went to Waycross in 1925, and he became the first doctor for the county, and he became the county health commissioner. And before that time, they had never had inoculations for the children in school. They had made inspections on milk products. There were many things that related to the health of Waycross and Ware County, Georgia, that he introduced. So he had 8 children who came along with him, and my mother was one of those. And she was, at the time, about 20. And they all went to the Episcopal Church in Waycross. And in 1925, she met my father, who was working at the Atlantic Coastline Railroad in Waycross. And they were both in the choir. In 26, they became engaged. In 27, they were married at the church in Waycross. And then my father found a job and with the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad in Russell, Kentucky. So they moved there, and I was born when they were living in Russell, Kentucky. I was born on the 23rd of July, 1928, but I wasn't born on the Kentucky side because we were right on the Ohio River. The nearest hospital was in Ohio, Ironton, Ohio. So I was born at Deaconess Hospital in Ironton, Ohio, which is immediately across the river from Russell, Kentucky. So during that early period, there's something that's very relative to this era and public health. We did not have inoculations except for 2 different things, diphtheria and smallpox. There were no immunities given to any infants. The first time you received any was first grade. First grade, we would all line up and go down the line, and we'd get a smallpox in our left arm, and we get a shot in the right arm. The diphtheria inoculation had only recently become available. It was not even perfected until the year 1927, 1928 by some lady doctors in Michigan, but it was very, very important step forward as far as medical protection. Now, before on any of these were available, before I went to the first grade, I had 5 different contagious diseases. I had measles, I had whooping cough, I had chicken pox, I had double pneumonia, and I had scarlet fever. Scarlet fever was the biggest killer preschool children in America in the decade of the 1920s and 1930s. And President Eisenhower's first child was a boy, and he died of scarlet fever when he was 4 years old. They did not know how to treat it, and only recently did they speculate that it probably was started when people would get strep throat. And there were no antibiotics. There was nothing to protect against that. And then it would transition, your immune system was weakened, and it transitioned into scarlet fever. I had scarlet fever when I was 4. And I had a temperature of 105. I was sick for 3 weeks, all at home. I had a big sign on my door saying that this was off limits for people. It was yellow and black. I can recall it specifically. I do also remember that all my skin peeled off. It's like a third degree burn. And that was one of the characteristics of that disease. Then the others were not very significant until I was five, and I was in Georgia in Waycross, where my grandfather was the doctor. And that summer I got double pneumonia before I went to first grade. And he treated it, and he got me well within a couple of weeks. No antibiotics, no sulfur drugs, nothing that came later that people would associate with anyone who had pneumonia. And there was no way to get oxygen in those days. So what he used was mustard plaster. Now, mustard plaster was used for people who had pneumonia, but also for asthmatics. And what it was is you got something like a pillowcase, and you made a poultice out of dry mustard. You can go to the grocery store and buy dry mustard, raw onions that were chopped, and water. You mixed them all up, and they generate heat. And you put this into a cloth binder, like a pillowcase, put on your chest, and then you get a wet towel, heavy towel, and you want it hot as you can stand it. Put that on top. The concept is that all of this heat is somehow going to break down the congestion in your lungs. They don't tell you this, nobody discussed it. All you know is a child, it burns like hell. I mean, it really, and this would go on day after day. But it produced the results that they needed because it saved a lot of lives. I have not found any doctors in recent decades who ever even heard of mustard plasters. And what's less would know how to make them. And there are a lot of other things that were done health-wise that are sort of passe and were not thought of because these new generations of health providers just never were taught these things in school. And I'm going to show you I'll tell you an example of this. Years ago, I was reading a book in American Heritage, and it was talking about lung cancer. And it was talking about these doctors who were in training at Johns Hopkins, and their teacher said, "We're going to go down to the morgue today, and we're going to look at a patient who died of lung cancer," and said, "You may not see this again for many years." This was before they associated smoking cigarettes specifically with the ultimate results. And it was before there was the impact of World War I, where so many young men were exposed to cigarettes and didn't know. Unfortunately, this continued all the way through World War II because in their e-rations, which they had in the field, they had two cigarettes in every one of their ration packets. And they were made supposedly generously by American Tobacco Company, but in fact to create a dependent group of people who were going to be buying their products when they got out of the military. So millions of young men who'd never smoked, they learned to smoke during World War II. When I was a student at the University of Florida, most of my roommates smoked, and most of them were veterans, and they had learned to smoke from these packets that they were provided that, no charge, but habit forming, yes. One day in Gainesville, I had a man who roomed in the same house as I. He would smoke, and he'd say, they would say, "Well, why don't you smoke?" And I said, "I never liked it." And they said, "Well, it's something that you're going to learn to like." And I said, "Well, I don't think so." And so he said, do you have a handkerchief? And I said, "Yeah." So I gave him this handkerchief, and he inhaled. So he inhaled, then he put the white handkerchief up, and then he exhaled back through there and handed it to me. It was black. He said, "This is the tar from my lungs, which was created by my smoking habits." Well, that didn't motivate me to smoke either, but basically I just never had a desire, and I had smoked irritated me, but I always had roommates that smoked. So in those days, you had to be tolerant. And wherever, even socially, people were tolerant. And it took all the way up until about 2 decades ago when people finally started realizing if you're hosting an event, you don't have to have ashtrays all around. You don't have to invite people to smoke in your home. And the whole attitude had changed, thank goodness. But it was as though smoking was non-harming, non-harmful, which was all not true. Mm-hmm. So this is going way back in a digression, but it relates to the healthcare. Now, I'll bring it to your attention because I had COVID in February 2021. The 18th of February, I went to the hospital. I was admitted. I was tested as being positive. I asked the admission doctor for hydroxychloroquine. And he said, we don't do that here. And I said, why? And he said, we just don't do that here. Well, I explained to him that it was my understanding that President Trump, his wife, and his son, all who had had COVID the summer before, that one of the things that they had been given was hydroxychloroquine. And there was another member of Congress who had that in a very severe case, and she thought she was going to die. And her husband went to the pharmacy and got hydroxychloroquine and gave it to her, and she felt it saved her life. But this doctor wouldn't listen. I found out later, because once I was out of the hospital after 16 days, and it was home I started to study about hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, other things that could be used to protect your life of people who have already been diagnosed as positive. It had no relevance to whether you'd had a shot in your arm or not. If you're sick, you're sick. You may die, but if you're properly treated, you may survive. Well, there were a lot of people who died because they weren't properly treated, because they didn't get existing medications. So I inquired, and I read a lot, and I went to the doctor 6 months after I got out of the hospital, and I had a general physical examination. All my scores were great. But then I said, I want to find out what degree of natural immunity I may have developed by having had the COVID, because that's the basis for immunity in so many things, like the measles, the mumps, the whooping cough, and all those. You have it as a child, so you don't have it again. So I had a special blood test, and they gave me a reading. They said, you have a very strong natural immunity. And I said, compared to what? I wanted them to compare it with some sort of a national standard. Well, they wouldn't give me an answer. So 6 months later, I asked for the same blood test to compare my blood reading then with 6 months prior. The score came back identical to the 0.01%. That was impossible. Statistically, it couldn't happen. Right then I realized that we did not have a standard to evaluate immunity against the COVID. And we didn't have one because they never wanted to develop one, because they wanted to push taking COVID shots. So, I mean, this is a long digression, but it relates to health right now in this generation. And so I talked about it, read about it. I read the book on Dr. Fauci as soon as it came out. It was a horror book. It was terrible. I read everything I could. But also I made a point to talk to every healthcare provider, doctors, nurses, PAs, home healthcare providers, all of whom had been required to take shots to keep their job or to keep their certificates, their license even to practice. It was all a requirement. So I would ask them, I said, did you wear a mask throughout? Because that was required. They said, yes. I said, did you take one, two, three, four, or five shots? And the answer was yes. I said, did you get COVID? Every answer was yes. Had you already had shots before you got COVID? And the answer again was yes. Did you have COVID more than once? Very often, they'd said two or three times. After COVID, after shots, yes. So it was very clear, the mask did not protect you against COVID. The mask did not preclude you transmitting any kind of infection. The shots did not prevent getting COVID. But there's an indication that the shots weakened your immune system, and the more shots you took, the weaker your natural immune system was and is. And there's statistical data on that right now, and it's available especially to Epoch Times, which is a weekly newspaper and does great research in the medical field. So this is a long digression associating healthcare from 1928 till 1934. Because in 1934, in first grade, we got in line, went down the line, and got the shots, but they were not with disposable needles. They were with needles that felt like nails. They're really big needles. They were reused all the time. But you'd go down the line, and they wouldn't necessarily change the needles. So the first person in line is going to get a sterile needle. After that, you get what you come. Mm-hmm. So they go down the line. In fact, the Army had the same procedure, and the lieutenant would always go down the line first. He was showing him he's brave. Mm-hmm. He's setting an example for the troops that followed. But in reality, he's getting the shot on an immune needle, and the rest of them are getting whatever the accumulation is by the time it gets to them. Mm-hmm. So this is a great digression on healthcare, but it's relevant to my early years and then relevant to recent years, because my wife had COVID the same time I did, mm-hmm. and she did not survive because she had a pre-existing breathing problem. But she may have survived had they given her either ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. She may have, but they didn't. And then I inquired why. And I was told basically follow the money. And they said, anyone who uses these medications and does not use the shots will not be reimbursed by Medicare or Medicaid for any expenses. This applied not only to the individual physicians, but also to the hospitals. So we're dealing with a whole industrial industry across the country that is letting policy be dictated by cash reimbursement from Washington. That's the key.